And that is partly why she is so anxious to have me spend a night with her, so that I'd have it to remember after she passed away. Please, Mother, I'll go without the new hat with ribbon streamers you promised me, if you'll let me. But Mother was adamant, and Di betook herself to a tearful pillow. Nan had no sympathy for her. Nan had no use for Jenny Penny.
I don't know what has got into the child, said Anne worriedly. She has never behaved like this before. As you say, that Penny girl seems to have bewitched her.
You were quite right in refusing to let her go to a place so far beneath her, Mrs. Doctor dear.
Oh, Susan, I don't want her to feel that anyone is beneath her. But we must draw the line somewhere. It's not Jenny so much. I think she's harmless enough, apart from her habit of exaggeration. But I'm told the boys are really dreadful. The Mowbray Narrows teacher is at her wit's end with them.
Do they tyrannize over you like that? Asked Jenny loftily when Di told her she was not to be allowed to go. I wouldn't let anyone use me like that. I have too much spirit. Why, I sleep out of doors all night whenever I take the notion. I suppose you'd never dream of doing that.
Di looked wistfully at this mysterious girl, who had often slept out all night.
How wonderful! You don't blame me for not going, Jenny? You know I want to go.
Of course I don't blame you. Some girls wouldn't put up with it, of course, but I suppose you just can't help it. We could have had fun. I'd planned we'd go fishing by moonlight in our back brook. We often do.
I've caught trout that long,
and we have the dearest little pigs and a new foal that's just sweet, and a litter of puppies.
Well, I guess I must ask Sadie Taylor. Her father and mother let her call her soul her own.
My father and mother are very good to me, protested Di loyally. And my father is the best doctor in P.E. Island. Everyone says so.
Putting on airs because you have a father and mother and I have none, said Jenny disdainfully.
Why, my father has wings and always wears a golden crown, but I don't go about with my head in the air on that account, do I?
Now, Di, I don't want to quarrel with you, but I hate to hear anyone bragging about their folks.
It's not etiquette, and I have made up my mind to be a lady. When that Persis Ford you're always talking of comes to Four Winds this summer, I am not going to associate with her.
There's something queer about her ma, Aunt Lena says. She was married to a dead man, and he come alive.
Oh, it wasn't like that at all, Jenny. I know. Mother told me. Aunt Leslie.
I don't want to hear about her. Whatever it is, it's something that had better not be talked of, Di.
There's the bell.
Are you really going to ask Sadie?
Choked Di, her eyes widening with hurt.
Well, not right at once. I'll wait and see. Maybe I'll give you one more chance. But if I do, it will be the last.
A few days later, Jenny Penny came to Di at recess.
I heard Jem saying your pa and ma went away yesterday and wouldn't be back till tomorrow night.
Yes, they went up to Avonlea to see Aunt Marilla.
Then it's your chance.
My chance?
To stay all night with me.
Oh, Jenny, but I couldn't.
Of course you can. Don't be a ninny.
They'll never know.
But Susan wouldn't let me.
You don't have to ask her. Just come home with me from school. Nan can tell her where you've gone, so she won't be worried. And she won't tell on you when your pa and ma come back. She'll be too scared they'd blame her.
Di stood in an agony of indecision. She knew perfectly well she should not go with Jenny, but the temptation was irresistible.
Jenny turned the full battery of her extraordinary eyes upon Di.
This is your last chance, she said dramatically. I can't go on so with who thinks herself too good at this. If you don't come, we part forever.
That settled it. Di, still in the thrall of Jenny Penny's passion, couldn't face out of parting forever, and then went alone that afternoon. Susan that Di had gone to stay all night with that Jenny Penny. Had Susan been her usual active self, she would have gone straight to Penny's and brought Di home. But Susan had strained her ankle that morning. While she could hop around and get drills, she knew she could never walk a mile down the baseline road. The Pennies had no telephone, and Jem and Walter flatly refused to go. They were invited to a mussel bake at the lighthouse and eat Di at the Pennies. Susan had to resign herself to the inevitable. Jenny came across more than a quarter mile. In spite of her prodding conscience, was happy. They went through so much beauty. Little bays of bracken, elm haunt, in the bays of woods, a rustling windy hollow, where you waded knee-deep in buttercups. a winding lane under young maples, a brook that was a rain garsum, a sunny pasture field full of strawberries. Di, just wakening to a perception of the loveliness of the world, was enraptured and almost wished Jenny wouldn't talk so much. That was all right at school, but here Di wasn't sure she wanted to hear about the time Jenny poisoned herself, accidentally, of course, by taking the wrong kind of medicine. Jenny painted her dying agonies finely. It was somewhat vague as to the reason she hadn't died after all. She had lost conscious, but the doctor had managed to pull her back from the brink of the grave. Though I've never been the same since. Di Blythe, what are you staring at? I don't believe you've been listening at all.
Oh, yes, I have, said Di guiltily. I do think you've had the most wonderful life, Jenny, but look at the view.
The view? What's a view?
Why, something you're looking at.
That! Waving her hand at the panorama of meadow and woodland and cloud-smitten hill before them, with that sapphire dent of sea between the hills. Jenny sniffed. Just a lot of old trees and cows. I've seen it 100 times. You're awful funny by spells, Di Blythe. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but sometimes I think you're not all there.
I really do.
But I suppose you can't help it. They say your ma is always raving like that.
Well, there's our place.
Di gazed at the penny house and lived through her first shock of disillusionment. Was this the mansion Jenny had talked of? It was big enough, certainly, and had the 5 bay windows, but it was woefully in need of painting, and much of the wooden lace was missing. The veranda had sagged badly, and the once lovely old fanlight over the front door was broken. The blinds were crooked, there were several brown paper panes, and the beautiful birch grove behind the house was represented by a few lean, sinewy old trees. The barns were in a very tumble-down condition. The yard was full of old rusty machinery, and the garden was a perfect jungle of weeds. Di had never seen such a looking place in her life, and for the first time it occurred to her to wonder if all Jenny's tales were true. Could anyone have so many narrow escapes of her life, even in 9 years, as she had claimed to have? Inside it was not much better. The parlor into which Jenny ushered her was musty and dusty. The ceiling was discolored and covered with cracks. The famous marble mantelpiece was only painted. Even Di could see that. And draped with a hideous Japanese scarf, held in place by a row of mustache cups. The stringy lace curtains were a bad color and full of holes. The blinds were of blue paper, much cracked and torn, with a huge basket full of roses depicted on them. As for the parlor being full of stuffed owls, there was a small glass case in one corner containing 3 rather disheveled birds, one with its eyes missing entirely. To Di, accustomed to the beauty and dignity of Ingleside, the room looked like something you had seen in a bad dream. The odd thing, however, was that Jenny seemed quite unconscious of any discrepancy between her descriptions and reality. Di wondered if she had dreamed that Jenny had told her such and such. It was not so bad outside. The little playhouse to Penny had built in the spruce corner, looking like a real house in miniature, was a very interesting place, and the little pig, the new foal, were just neat. As for the litter of mongrel puppies, they were as woolly and delightful as if they had belonged to the dog cast of Vere de Vere. It was especially adorable, with long brown ears and a white spot on its forehead, a wee pink tongue and paws. Di was bitterly disappointed to learn that they had all been promised.
"Though I don't know as we could give you one, even if they weren't," said Jenny.
"Uncle's awful particular where he puts his dog. We've heard you get a dog to stay at Ingleside at all. There must be something queer about you. Uncle says dogs know things people don't."
"I'm sure they can't know anything nasty about us," cried Di.
"Well, I hope not. Is your paw cruel to your ma?"
"No, of course he isn't."
"Well, I heard that he beat her. Beat her till she screamed. But, of course, I didn't believe that. Ain't awful the lies people tell. Anyway, I've always liked you, Di, and I'll always stand up for you."
Di felt she ought to be very grateful for this. Somehow she was not. She would feel very misplaced, and the glamour with which Jenny had been invested in her eyes was suddenly and irrevocably gone. She did not feel the old thrill when Jenny told her about the time she had been almost drowned falling in a mill pond. She did not believe it. Jenny just imagined those things. Likely the millionaire uncle and the $1,000 diamond ring and the missionary to the leopards had just been imagined, too. Di felt as flat as a prick spoon.
But the gammy, surely gammy was real. I originally arrested wretched lady in a numped cotton print, told them gammy wanted to see the visitor. Get it, explained Jenny. We always take everybody who comes in to see her. She gets it.
Mind you, don't forget to ask her how her backache is, cautioned Alina. She doesn't like it if folks don't remember her back.
And Uncle John, said Jenny. Don't forget to ask her how Uncle John is.
Who is Uncle John? Asked Di.
A son of hers who died 50 years ago, explained Aunt Lena. He was sick for years afore he died, and Gammy kind of got to hearing folks ask how he was. She misses it. At the door of Gammy's room, Di suddenly hung back. All at once she was terribly frightened of this inquiry.
What's the matter, Jenny? Nobody's going to bite you.
Did she really live before the flood, Jenny?
Of course not. Whoever said she did? She'll be 100, though, if she lives till her next birthday. Come on.
Di went gingerly. In a small, badly cluttered bedroom, Gammy lay in a huge bed. Her face, unbelievably wrinkled and shrunken, looked like an old monkey's. She peered at Di with sunken, red-rimmed eyes and said testily,
Stop staring. Who are you?
This is Diana Blythe, Gammy, said Jenny, a rather subdued Jenny.
Humph! A nice high-sounding name. They tell me you've got a proud sister.
Nan isn't proud, cried Di with a flash of spirit. Had Jenny been running down Nan?
A little saucy, ain't you? I wasn't brought up to speak like that to my betters. She is proud. Anyone who walks with her head in the air like young Jenny tells me she does is proud. One of your hoity-toities. Don't contradict me.
Gammy looked so angry that Di hastily inquired how her back was.
Who says I've got a back? Such presumption. My back's my own business. Come here. Come close to my bed.
Di whipped herself 1,000 miles away. What was this dreadful old woman do to her? Gammy hitched herself alert edge of the bed and put a claw-like hand on Di's hair.
Sort of carroty, but real slick. That's a pretty dress. Turn it up and show me your petticoat.
Di obeyed, thankful that she had on her white petticoat with its trimming of Susan's crochet lace. But what sort of a family was it where you wore your petticoat?
I always judge a girl by her petticoats, said Gammy. Yours'll pass. Now your drawers.
Di dared not refuse. She lifted her petticoat.
Humph! Lace on them, too. That's extravagance. And you've never asked after John.
How is he? Gasped Di.
How is he? Said she. Bold as brass. He might be dead for all you know. Tell me this. Is it true your mother has a gold thimble? A solid gold thimble?
Yes. Daddy gave it to her last birthday.
Well, I'd never have believed it. Young Jenny told me she had, but you can't never believe a word young Jenny says. A solid gold thimble. I never heard the beat of that. Well, you'd better go out and get your suppers. Eating never goes out of fashion. Jenny, pull up your pants. One leg's hanging below your dress. Let us have decency, at least.
My pant... drawer leg isn't hanging down, said Jenny indignantly.
Pants for pennies and drawers for Blythes. That's the distinction between you and always will be. Don't contradict me.
The whole Penny family were assembled around the supper table in the big kitchen. Di had not seen any of them before except Aunt Lena. But as she shot a glance around the board, she understood why Mother and Susan had not wanted her to come here. The tablecloth was ragged and daubed with ancient gravy stains. The dishes were a nondescript assortment. As for the pennies, Di had never sat at a table with such company before, and she wished herself safely back at Ingleside. But she must go through with it now. Uncle Ben, as Jenny called him, sat at the head of the table. He had a flaming red beard and a bald, gray-fringed head. His bachelor, Parker, lank and unshaven, had arranged himself at an angle convenient for spitting in the wood-box, which he did at frequent intervals. The boy, Kurt, and George Andrew, 13, had pale blue fishy eyes with old stare and bare skin showing through holes in their ragged shirts. Kurt had his hand, which he had cut on a broken bottle, tied up with a blood-stained rag. Annabel Penny, 11, and Gert Penny, 10, were two rather pretty girls with round, brown eyes. Tuppy, aged 2, had delightful curls and rosy cheeks, and the baby with roguish black eyes on Aunt Lena's lap would have been adorable if it had been clean. Kurt, Why did you clean your nails when you knew company was coming?
Demanded Jenny.
Annabelle, don't speak with your mouth full. I'm the only one who ever tried to teach them manners, she explained, decidedly.
Shut up, said Uncle Ben in a great booming voice.
I won't shut up. You can't make me shut up, Jenny.
Don't sass your uncle, said Aunt Lena placidly. Come now, girls, behave like ladies. Kurt passed the potatoes to Miss Blythe.
Oh, Miss Blythe, sniggered Kurt. But Dinah had got at least three. For the first time in life she had been called Miss Blythe. For a wonder the food was good and abundant. Di, who was hungry, would have enjoyed the meal, though she hated drinking out of a chit cup, if she had only been clean, and if everybody hadn't quarreled so. Private fights were going on all the time, between George and Kurt, between Kurt and Annabelle, between Gert and Jen, even between Uncle Ben and Aunt Lena. They had a terrible fight and hurled the bitterest accusation to Aunt Lena. Uncle Ben all the fine men she might have married, and Beth said wish I'd met anybody but him. Did it for my father and mother fought like the die. Oh, if I were only back home. Don't suck your thumb, Tuppy, said Tuppy, she thought. Had such a time breaking Rilla of sucking her thumb. Instantly, Kurt was red with rage.
Let him alone, he shouted. He can suck his thumb if he likes. We ain't bossed to death like you Ingleside kids are. Who do you think you are?
Kurt, Kurt, Miss Blythe will think you haven't any manners, said Aunt Lena. She was quite calm and smiling again, and put 2 teaspoons of sugar in Uncle Ben's tea. Don't mind him, dear. Have another piece of pie.
Di not want another piece of pie.
Only home, and she did not see how it could be brought about.
Well,
boomed he, drained the last of his tea noisily from the saucer.
That's so much over. Get up in the morning, work all day, eat 3 meals, and go to bed. What a life!
Pa loves his little joke, smiled Aunt Lena.
Talking of jokes, I saw the Methodist minister in Flagg's store today. He tried to contradict me when I said that. You talk on Sunday, I told him. It's my turn now. Prove to me there's a God, I told him. It's the talking, says he. They all laughed like ninnies. Thought he was smart.
No God. The bun seemed falling out of Di's world. She wanted to cry. Chapter 9. It was worse after supper. Before that, she and Jenny had been alone, at least. Now there was a mob. George Andrew grabbed her hand and galloped her through a mud before he could hate them. Di had never been treated like this in her life. Jem and Walter teased her, as did Ken Ford, but she did not know anything about boys like these. Kurt offered her a chew of gum from his mouth and was mad when she refused it.
I'll put a live mouth on you, he yelled. Smarty cat, stuck up at it. Got a sister for a brother.
Walter isn't a sissy, said Di. She was half sick of fright, but she would not hear Walter called names.
He is. He writes poetry. Do you know what I'd do if I'd a brother that writ poetry? I'd drown him, like they do kittens.
Talking of kittens, there's a lot of wild ones in the barn, said Jen. Let's go and them out. Di simply would not go hunting kittens with those boys. Said so. We've got plenty of kittens at home, not a living, she said proudly.
I don't believe it, cried Jen.
You haven't. Nobody had 11 kittens. It wouldn't be right to have 11 kittens.
One cat has 5 and the other 6. And I'm not going to the barn anyhow. I fell down off the loft in Amy Taylor's barn last winter. I'd have been killed if I hadn't lit on a pile of chaff.
Well, I'd have fell off our loft once if Kurt hadn't caught me, said Jen sulkily. Nobody had any right to be falling off lofts but her. Di blind admires the evidence of her.
You should say, I'd have fallen, said Di. And from that moment everything was over between her and Jenny. But the night had to be got through somehow. They did not go to bed too late, because none of the Pennies ever went to bed early. The big bedroom where Jenny took her at 10:30 had 2 beds in it. Annabelle and Gert were getting ready for theirs. Di looked at the others. The pillows were very frowsy. The quilt needed washing very badly. The paper, the famous paper, had leaked on, and even the parents did not very well. On the stand by the bed were a granite pitcher and a tin wash basin, half full of dirty water. She could never wash her face in that. Well, for once she must have not washed her face. At least the nightgown Aunt Lena had left for was clean. When Di got up from saying her prayers, Jenny left.
My, but you're old-fashioned. You look so funny and holy saying your prayers. I didn't know any said prayers now. Prayers ain't any good. What do you them for?
I've got to save my soul, said Di, quoting Susan.
I haven't any soul, mocked Jenny.
Perhaps not, but I have, said Di, drawing. Jenny looked at her. But the spell in his eyes was broken. Never again would Di succumb to its magic. "'You're not the girl I were, I am Blythe,' said Jenny sadly, as one much deceived. Before Di could reply, George Andrew and Kirk rushed into the room. George Andrew wore a mask, a hideous thing with an enormous nose. Di screamed.
"'Stop squealing like a pig under a gate,' ordered George Andrew. "'You've got kiss goodnight. "'If you don't, we'll lock you up in that closet, and it's full of rats,' said Kurt.
George Andrew advanced towards Di, who shrieked again and retreated before him. The mask paralyzed her with terror. She knew quite well it was only George Andrew behind it, and she was not afraid of him. But she would die if that awful mask came near her. She knew she would.
Just as it seemed that the dreadful nose was touching her face, she tripped over a stool and fell backward on the floor, striking her head on the sharp edge of Al's bed as she fell. For a moment she was dazed and lay with her eyes shut.
"'She's gone dead! She's gone dead!' sniffled Kurt, beginning to cry. "'Oh, won't you get a licking if you've killed George Andrew?' said Anna. "'Maybe she's only pretending,' said Kurt. "'Put a worm on her. I've some in this can. If she's only foxing, that will bring her to.'
Di heard this, but was too frightened to open her eyes. Perhaps they would go away and leave her alone if they thought her dead. But if they put a worm on her...
"'Prick her with a pin. If she bleeds, she ain't dead,' said Kurt.
She could step in, but not a worm.
"'She ain't dead. She can't be dead,' whispered Jenny. "'You've just scared her into a fit. If she comes, she'll be screeching ice, and Uncle Ben'll come in and daylight out of us. I wish I'd never asked her here, the fraid cat.'
"'Do you suppose we could carry her home before she comes to?' suggested George Andrew.
"'Oh, if they only would!'
"'We couldn't. Not that far,' said Jenny.
"'It's only a quarter of a mile across the lot. We'll each take an arm or you, Kurt, and me and Annabelle.'
Nobody but the Penny could have conceived such an idea, or carried it out if they had. But they were used to doing anything they took it into their heads to do, and a lambasting from the head of the household was something to be avoided if possible. Dad didn't bother about them, up to a certain point, but beyond that, good night.
"'She comes to while wearing, we'll just cut and run,' said George Andrew.
There wasn't the least danger of Di come to, she'd witness, when she felt herself being hoisted up between the four of them. They crept stairs and out of the house, across the yard and over the long clover field, Padwood Hill. Twice they had to lay her down while they rested. They were quite sure now she was dead, and all they wanted was to get her home without being seen. If Jenny Penny never prayed in her life before, she was praying now, that nobody in the village would be up. If they could get Di Blythe home, they would all swear she had got so sick at time, sis go. What happened after that would be no concern of theirs. Then to open her eyes once as they plotted this, the sleeping world around looked very strange. The fir trees were dark and alien. The stars were laughing at her.
I don't like such a big sky, but if I could just hold on a little spell longer, I'll be home. If they find out that I'm not dead, they'll just leave me here, and I'll never get home in dark alone.
When the Pennies dropped Di on the veranda of Ingleside, they ran like mad. Di did not dare come back to life too soon, but at last she ventured to open her eyes. Yes, she was home. It seemed almost too good to be true. She had been a very, very naughty girl, but she was quite sure she would never be naughty again. She sat up, and the shrimp came stealthily up the stairs and rubbed against her, purring. She hugged him to her. How nice and warm and friendly he was. She did not think she would be able to get in. She knew Susan would have all the doors locked when Dad was away, and she dared not wake Susan up at this hour. But she did not mind. It was cold enough, but she would get into the hammock and cuddle down with the shrimp, knowing that, near to her, behind locked doors, were Susan, the boys, and Nan, and home. How strange the world was after dark. Was everyone in it asleep but her? The large white roses on the bush by the small human faces in the night. The smell of the mint was like a friend. There was a glint of firefly in the orchard. After all, she would be able to breathe out all night. But it was not to be. Two dark figures came through the gate of the driveway, Gilbert by the back to force open a kitchen window, but Anne came up the steps and stood looking in amazement at the poor mite who sat there with her awful cat.
"Mummy! Oh, Mummy!"
She was safe in Mother's arms.
"My darling, what does it mean?" "Oh, Mummy, I was bad, but I'm so sorry, and you were right, and Gaddy was so dreadful, but I thought you wouldn't be till tomorrow."
"Daddy got a telephone from Lowbridge. They have to operate on Miss Parker tomorrow, and Parker to be there. So we caught the evening train, and walked up from the station. Now tell me." The hostile had got in and opened the front door. He thought he had effected a very silent entrance, but Susan had ears that could hear a bat squeak when the safety of Ingleside was concerned, and she came limping downstairs with a wrapper over her nightgown. There were exclamations and explanations, but Anne cut them short. "Nobody is blaming you, Susan, dear. Di has been very naughty, but she knows it, and I think she has had her punishment. I'm sorry we've disturbed you. You must go straight back to bed, and the doctor will see to your ankle."
"I was not asleep, Mrs. Doctor, dear. Do you think I could sleep knowing where that blessed child was? And ankle or no ankle, I am going to get you both a cup of tea."
"Mummy," said Di from her own white pillow, "is Daddy ever cruel to you?"
"Cruel?
To me? Why, Di? The Pennies said he was, said he beat you."
"Dear, you know what the Pennies are now, so you know better than to worry your small head over anything they said. There is always a bit of malicious gossip floating round in any place. People like that invent it. You must never bother about it."
"Are you going to scold me in the morning, Mummy?"
"No, I think you've learned your lesson. Now go to sleep, precious."
"Mummy is so sensible," was Di's last conscious thought. But Susan, as she stretched out peacefully in bed, with her ankle expertly and comfortably bandaged, was saying to herself, "I must hunt up the fine-tooth comb in the morning, and when I see my fine Miss Jenny Penny, I shall give her a ticking off she will not forget." Jenny Penny never got the promised ticking off, for she came no more to the Glen School. Instead, she went with the other Pennies to Mowbray Narrow School, whence rumors drifted back of her yarns, among them being one of how Di Blythe, who lived in the big house at Glen St. Mary, but was always coming down to sleep with her, had fainted one night and had been carried home at midnight, pick-a-back, by her, Jenny Penny, alone and unassisted. The Ingleside people had knelt and kissed her hands out of gratitude, and the doctor himself had got out his fringed-top buggy and his famous dappled gray span and driven her home. "And if there is ever anything I can do for you, Miss Penny, for your kindness to my beloved child, you have only to name it. My best heart's blood would not be enough to repay you. I would go to Equatorial Africa to reward you for what you have done," the doctor had vowed.
Chapter 30 "I know something you don't know. Something you don't know, something you don't know," chanted Dovey Johnson, as she teetered back and forth on the very edge of the wharf. It was Nan's turn for the spotlight, Nan's turn to add a tale to the do-you-remembers of after Ingleside years. Though Nan to the day of her death would blush to be reminded of it, she had been so silly. Nan shuddered to see Dovey teetering, and yet it had a fascination. She was so sure Dovey would fall off sometime, and then what? But Dovey never fell. Her luck always held. Everything Dovey did, or said she did, which were perhaps two very different things, although Nan, brought up at Ingleside, where nobody ever told anything but the truth, was too innocent and credulous to know that, had a for Nan. Dovey, who was 11 and had lived in Charlottetown all her life, knew so much more than Nan, who was only 8. Charlottetown, Dovey said, was the only place where people knew anything. What could you know should have been a one-horse place like Glen St. Mary? Dovey was spending part of her vacation with her Aunt Ella in the Glen, and she and Nan had struck up a very intimate friendship, in spite of the difference in their ages. Perhaps because Nan looked up to Dovey, who seemed to be almost grown up, with the adoration we needs must give the highest when we see it, or think we see it. Dovey liked her humble and adoring little saddle. "There's no harm in Nan Blythe. She's only a bit soft," she told Aunt Ella. Watchful side could he end out of way about Dovey, even if, as Anne reflected, her mother was a cousin of the Avon Pies, and no objection to Nan's chumming with her, though Susan from the first mistrusted those gooseberry-green eyes with their pale golden lashes. But what would you? Dovey was nice-mannered, well-dressed, ladylike, and did not talk too much. Susan could not give any reason for her mistrust, and held her peace. Dovey would be going home when school opened, and certainly fine-tooths in case. So Nan spent most of their spare time at the wharf, where there was generally a ship or two with their folded wings, and Rainbow Valley hardly knew Nan that August. The other Ingle children didn't care greatly for Dovey, and no love was lost. She had made a practical joke on Walter, and I had been furious and said things. Dovey was, it seemed, fond of a practical joke. Perhaps that was why none of the Glen girls ever tried to lure her from Nan. "Oh, please tell me," pleaded Nan. But they only winked a wicked eye, and said that Nan was too young to be told such a thing. This was just maddening.
"Please tell me, Dovey."
"Can't. It was told me as a secret, and she had. I'm the only person in the world that knows it now. I promise I heard never tell a soul."
"You'd tell somebody. You couldn't help it."
"I wouldn't. I could so," cried Nan. "People say you folks at Ingleside tell each other everything.
Susan'd pick it out of you in no time.
She wouldn't. I know lots of things I've never told Susan. Secrets. I'll tell mine to you if you'll tell me yours.
Oh, I'm not interested in the secrets of a little girl like you, Savvy.
Nice insult, that. Nan thought her little secrets were lovely.
That one wild cherry tree she had found blooming in the spruce wood away back behind Mr. Taylor's barn. Her dream of a tiny white fairy lying on a lily pad in the marsh. Her fancy of a boat coming up the harbor, drawn by swans attached to silver.
Romance she was beginning to weave about the beautiful lady at the old McAllister place.
They were all very wonderful and magical to Nan. She felt, as she thought it over, that she did not have to tell them to Dovey after all.
But what did Dovey know about her that she didn't know? The query haunted Nan like a mosquito.
The next day, Dovey again referred to her secret knowledge.
I've been thinking it over, Nan. Perhaps you ought to know it, since it's about you. Of course, what Aunt Kate meant was that I mustn't tell anyone but the person concerned. Look, you'll give me that china stag of yours, I'll know about you.
Oh, I couldn't give you that, Dovey. Susan gave it me my last birthday. It would hurt her feelings dreadfully.
All right, then. If you'd rather have your old stag than know an important thing about yourself, you can keep him. I don't care.
I'd rather keep it. I always like to know things other girls don't. It makes you important.
I'll look at you next Sunday in church and I'll think to myself, just do what I know about you and love. It'll be fun.
Is that nice?
Queer.
Oh, it's very romantic. It's like something you'd read in a storybook. But never mind. You ain't interested, and I know what I know.
By the time Nan was crazy with curiosity, life wouldn't be worth living if she couldn't find out what Dovey's mysterious knowledge was. She had a sudden inspiration.
Dovey, I can't give you my stag, but if you'll tell me what you know about me, I'll give you my red parasol.
Dovey's gooseberry eyes gleamed. She had been eaten up by the of that parasol.
The new red parasol your mother brought you from town last week? She bargained.
Nan nodded. Her breath came quickly.
Was it? Oh, was it possible that Dovey would really tell her?
Will your mother let you? Demanded Dovey. Nan nodded again, but a little uncertainly. She was none too sure of it. Dovey scented the uncertainty.
You'll have to have the salt here, she said firmly, before I can tell you. No parasol, no secret.
I'll bring it tomorrow, promised Nan hastily.
She just had to what Dovey knew about her, that all there was to it.
Well, I'll think it over, said doubtfully. Don't get mixed, I'll tell you after all. You're too young.
I've told you often enough.
I'm older than I was yesterday, pleaded Nan.
Oh, Dovey, I don't right know it, said Dovey crushingly.
You tell Anne, that's your mother.
Of course I know my own mother's name, said Nan, a trifle on her dignity.
Secrets are no secret limits.
I do, I wouldn't let anybody Ingleside.
Will you swear it?
Swear it? Don't pulpit.
Of course I mean just promising solemn.
I promise solemnly.
Solemn now.
Nan didn't see how she could be solemn. Her face would that if she was.
Clasp your hands, look at sky, cross your and hope to die, said Dovey,
Nan through the ritual.
You'll bring the parasol to me, and we'll see, said Dovey.
What did your mother do before she was married, Nan?
She taught school.
And taught it well, said Nan.
Well, I was just wondering.
Mother thinks it was a mistake for your dad to marry her. Nobody knew anything about her family. And the girl says, I must be going now. Au revoir.
Nan knew that meant, till tomorrow. She was very proud of having a chum who could talk French.
She continued to sit on the wharf long after Dovey had gone home. She liked to sit on the wharf and watch the fishing boats going out and coming in, and the shifting down the harbor, bound to fair lands far away. Like Jem, she often wished she could sail away in a ship, blue harbor past the bar of shadowy dunes, past the lighthouse point where at night the revolving Four Winds light became an outpost of mystery. Out, out to the blue mist, off, on enchanted islands and golden morning seas. Nan flew on wings of her imagination all over the world as she squat there on the old sagging wharf. But this afternoon she was all up for Dovey's secret. Would Dovey really tell her? What would it be? What could it be? And what about those girls father might have married? Nan liked to speculate about those girls. None of them might have been her. But that was horrible. What would be her mother except mother? The thing was simply unthinkable.
I think Dovey Johnson is going to tell me a secret, Nan confided to Mother that night, when she was being kissed by Bi. Of course I won't be able to tell even you, Mummy, because I've promised I wouldn't. You won't mind, will you, Mummy?
Not at all, said Anne, much amused. When Nan went down to the wharf the next day, she took the parasol. It was her parasol, she told herself. It had been given to her, so she had a perfect right to do what she liked with it. Having quieted her conscience with this sophistry, she slipped away when nobody could see her. It gave her a pang to think of giving up her dear, gay little parasol, but by this time the craze to find out what Dovey knew had become too strong to be resisted. "Here's the parasol, Dovey," she said breathlessly, "and tell me the secret." Dovey was really taken aback. She had never meant for matters to go as far as this. She had never believed Nan Blythe's mother would let her give away her red parasol. She pursed her lips. "I don't know as that shade red will suit my complexion after all. It's rather gaudy. I guess I won't tell." Nan had a spirit of her own, and Dovey had not yet quite charmed it into blind submission. Nothing roused it more quickly than injustice. "A bargain is a bargain, Dovey Johnson. You said the parasol for the secret. Here is the parasol, and you've got to keep your promise." "Oh, very well," said Dovey in a bored way. Everything grew very still. The gusts of wind had died away. The water stopped glug-glugging round piles of the wharf. Nan shivered with delicious ecstasy. She was going to find out at last what Dovey knew. "You know the Jimmy Thomases down at the harbor mouth," said Dovey. "Six-toed Jimmy Thomas?" Nan nodded. Of course she knew the Thomases, at least knew of them. Six-toed Jimmy sometimes called at Ingleside, selling fish. Susan said you never could be sure of getting good ones from him. Nan did not like the look of him. He had a bald head, with a fluff of curly white hair on either side of it, and a red hooked nose. But what could the Thomases possibly have to do with the matter? "And you know Cassie Thomas?" went on Dovey. Nan had seen Cassie Thomas once when Six-Toed Jimmy had brought her round with him in his fish wagon. Cassie was just about her own age, with a mop of red curls and bold greenish-gray eyes. She had stuck her tongue out at Nan. "Well," Dovey drew a long breath, "this is the truth about you. You are Cassie Thomas, and she is Nan Blythe." Nan stared at Dovey. She hadn't the faintest glimmer of Dovey's meaning. What she had said made no sense.
What do you mean?"
"It's plain enough, I should think," said Dovey, with a pitying smile. Since she had been forced to tell this, she was to make it worth the telling. "You and her were born the same night. It was when the Thomases lived in the Glen. First took Di's twin down to Thomas's and put her in the cradle and took you back to Di's mother. She didn't dare take Di, too, or she would have. She hated your mother, and she took that way of getting even. And that is why you are really Cassie Thomas, and you ought to be living down there at the harbor mouth, and poor Cass ought to be up at Ingleside instead of being banged about by that old stepmother of hers. I feel so sorry for her many's the time." Nan believed every word of this preposterous yarn. She had never been lied to in her life, and not for one moment did she doubt the truth of Dovey's tale. It never occurred to her that anyone, much less her beloved Dovey, would or could make up such a story. She gazed at Dovey with anguished, disillusioned eyes.
How did your Aunt Kate find it out?" she gasped through dry lips.
"The nurse told her on her deathbed," said Dovey solemnly. "I sensed her. Aunt never told anyone but me. When I came to Glen and saw Cassie lying, I took a good look. She's got red hair, eyes color as your mother's. You've got brown eyes and brown hair. That's why you don't look like Di. Twins always look exactly alike. And Cass has just the same kind of ears as your father, lying so nice and flat against her head. I don't suppose anything can be done about it now. But I've all thought it wasn't fair, you having such an easy time and being kept like a doll, and poor Cass, Nan, in rags, and not even getting enough to eat, many's the time. And old beating her comes home drunk. Why, what are you looking at me like that for?" Nan's pain was greater than she could bear. All was horribly clear to her now. She always thought it funny she and Di didn't look one bit alike. This was why.
"I hate you for telling me, Dovey Johnson."
Dovey shrugged her fat shoulders.
"I didn't tell you'd like it, did I? You made me tell. Where are you going?"
For Nan, white and dizzy, had risen to her feet.
"Home. To tell Mother," she said miserably. "You mustn't. You mustn't. Remember, you swore you'd tell," cried Dovey.
Nan's her. It was true she had promised not to tell, and Mother always said you mustn't break a promise.
"I guess I'll be getting home myself," said Dovey, not altogether liking the look of Nan.
He snatched up parasol and off, her plump, bare legs twinkling along the old wharf. Behind her, she left a broken-hearted child, sitting amid the ruins of her small universe. Dovey didn't care. Soft was no name for Nan. It really wasn't much fun to fool her. Of course, she would tell her mother as soon as she got home and find out she had been hoaxed. Just well I'm going home Sunday, reflected Dovey. Nan sat on the wharf for what seemed hours, blind, crushed, despairing. She wasn't Mother's child. She was Six-Toed Jimmy's child. Six-Toed Jimmy, of whom she had always had a secret dread simply because of his six toes. She had no business to be living in Ingleside, loved by Mother and Dad.
Oh!
Nan gave a piteous little moan. Mother and Dad wouldn't love her anymore. All their love would go to Cassie Thomas. Nan put her hand to her head.
It makes me dizzy, she said.
Chapter 31
What is the reason you are not eating anything, Pet? Asked Susan at the supper table.
Were you out in the sun too long, dear? Asked Mother anxiously. Does your head ache?
Yes,
said Nan. But it wasn't her head that ached. Was she telling a lie to Mother? And if so, how many more would she have to tell? For Nan knew she would never be able to eat again, never so long as this horrible knowledge was hers. And she knew she could never tell Mother, not so much because of promise. Hadn't Susan said once that a bad promise was better broken than kept? But because it would hurt Mother. Somehow Nan knew beyond any doubt that it would hurt Mother horribly, and Mother mustn't, shouldn't be hurt. Nor Dad. And yet there was Cassie Thomas. She wouldn't call her Nan Blythe. It made Nan feel awful beyond description to think of Cassie Thomas as being Nan Blythe. She felt as if it blotted her out altogether. If she wasn't Nan Blythe, she wasn't anybody. She would not be Cassie Thomas. But Cassie Thomas haunted her. For a week Nan was beset by her, a wretched week during which Anne and Susan were really worried over the child, who wouldn't eat and wouldn't play and, as Susan said, just moped around. Was it because Dovey Johnson had gone home? Nan said it wasn't. Nan said it wasn't anything. She just felt tired. Dad looked her over and prescribed a dose which Nan took meekly. It was not so bad as castor oil, but even castor oil meant nothing now. Nothing meant anything except Cassie Thomas. And the awful question which had emerged from her confusion of mind and taken possession of her. Shouldn't Cassie Thomas have her rights? Was it fair that she, Nan Blythe, Nan clung to her identity frantically, should have all the things Cassie Thomas was denied and which were hers by rights? No, it wasn't fair. Nan was despairingly sure it wasn't fair. Somewhere in Nan there was a very strong sense of justice and fair play, and it became increasingly borne in upon her that it was only fair that Cassie Thomas should be told. After all, perhaps nobody would care very much. Mother and Dad would be a little upset at first, of course, but as soon as they knew that Cassie Thomas was their own child, all their love would go to Cassie, and she, Nan, would be of no account to them. Mother would kiss Cassie Thomas and sing to her in the summer twilights, sing the song Nan liked best. I saw a ship a-sailing on the sea, and oh, it was all laden with pretty things for me. Nan and Di had often talked about the day their ship would come in, but now the pretty things, her share of them anyhow, would belong to Cassie Thomas. Cassie Thomas would take her part as fairy queen in the forthcoming Sunday school concert, and wear her dazzling band of tinsel. How Nan had looked forward to that! Susan would make fruit puffs for Cassie Thomas, and Pussy Willow would purr for her. She would play with Nan's dolls in Nan's moss-carpeted playhouse in the maple grove, and sleep in her bed. Would Di like that? Would Di like Cassie Thomas for a sister? There came a day when Nan knew she could bear it no longer. She must do what was fair. She would go down to the harbor mouth and tell the Thomases the truth. They could tell Mother and Dad. Nan felt that she simply could not do that. Nan felt a little better when she had come to this decision, but very, very sad. She tried to eat a little supper because it would be the last meal she would ever eat at Ingleside. I'll always call Mother, Mother, thought Nan desperately, and I won't call Six-Toed Jimmy Father. I'll just say Mr. Thomas very respectfully. Surely he won't mind that. But something choked her. Looking up, she read castor oil in Susan's eye. Little Susan thought she wouldn't be here at bedtime to take it. Cassie Thomas would have to swallow it. That was the one thing Nan didn't envy Cassie Thomas. Nan went off immediately after supper. She must go before it was dark, or her courage would fail her. She went in her checked gingham play dress, not daring to change it, lest Susan or Mother ask why. Besides, all her nice dresses really belonged to Cassie Thomas. But she did put on the new apron Susan had made for her, such a smart little scalloped apron, the scallops bound in turkey red. Nan loved that apron. Surely Cassie Thomas wouldn't grudge her that much. She walked down to the village, through the village, past the wharf road, and down the harbor road, a gallant, indomitable little figure. Nan had no idea that she was a heroine. On the contrary, she felt very much ashamed of herself, because it was so hard to do what was right and fair, so hard to keep from hating Cassie Thomas, so hard to keep from fearing six-toed Jimmy, so hard to keep from turning round and running back to Ingleside. It was a lowering evening. Out to sea hung a heavy black cloud, like a great dark bat. Fitful lightning played over the harbor and the wooded hills beyond. The cluster of fishermen's houses at the harbor mouth lay flooded in a red light that escaped from under the cloud. Pools of water here and there glowed like great rubies. A ship, silent, white-sailed, was drifting past the dim, misty dunes to the mysterious calling ocean. The gulls were crying strangely. Nan did not like the smell of the fishing houses or the groups of dirty children who were playing and fighting and yelling on the sands. They looked curiously at Nan when she stopped to ask them which was six-toed Jimmy's house. "What business with him?" you ran away. "Had no more that," yelled a girl. "Too stuck up to answer a civil question." The boy got in front of her. "See that house back of Thomas's?" he said. "It's got a sea serpent in it, and I'll lock you up in it if you don't tell me what you want with six-toed Jimmy." "Come now, Miss Proudy," taunted a big girl from the Glen, "and Glenners all think they're the cheese. Answer Bill's question." "If you don't look out," said another boy, "I'm going round some kittens, quietly too." "If you got a dime about you, I'll sell you a tooth," said a black-eyed girl, grinning. "I had one pulled yesterday." "I haven't got a dime, and your tooth wouldn't be of any use to me," said Nan, plucking up a little spirit. "You let me alone." "None of your lip," said the black-browed. Nan started to run. The sea serpent boy stuck out a foot and tripped her up. She fell her length on the red-rippled sand. The other screamed with laughter. "You won't hold your so napkin, proud, about here with your red scallops." Then someone exclaimed, "There's Blue Jack's boat coming in." And away they all ran. The black cloud had lower, and every ruby pool was gray. Nan picked herself up. Her dress was plastered with sand, and her stockings were soiled. But she was free from her tormentors. Would her in the future? She must not cry. She must not. The rickety footsteps led up to six-toed Jimmy's door. Like all the harbor mouthes, six-toed Jimmy's gray lock would be out the reach of any unusual sight, and underneath it was filled with a medley of broken dishes and cans, old lobster traps, all kinds of rubbish. The door opened, and looked into a kitchen, the like of which she had never seen in her life. The bare floor was dirty. The ceiling was stained and smoked. The sink was full of dirty dishes. The remains of a meal were on the rickety old wooden table, and horrid big black flies were swarming over it. A woman in a mop of gray hair was sitting on a rocker nursing a fat lump of a baby. A baby gray with dirt. "My sister, Nan." There's sarcastic to Jimmy, for which her fact and felt grateful. "Who are you and what do you want?" said the woman rather ungraciously. She had asked Nan in, but Nan walked in. It was beginning to rain and unmade bush. Nan knew she must say what had come to before her courage failed her, or she would turn and run from that house and that dreadful baby dreadful. "I want to see Cassie, please," she said. "I have something important to tell her."
"Indeed, now," said the woman, "it must be important from the size of you. Well, Cass isn't home. Her dad took her up to the upper glen, or with the storm up, there's no telling when they'll be back. Sit down."
And Dana broke a chair. She had known the harbor mouth folks were poor, but she had not known any of them were like this. Mrs. Tom Fitch in the glen was poor, but Mrs. Tom Fitch's house was as neat and tidy as Ingleside. Of course, everyone knew that six-toed drank everything, and this was to be her home henceforth. "Anyhow, I'll try to clean it up," thought Nan forlornly. But her heart was like lead. The flame of high self-sacrifice which had lured her on had gone out. "What are you wanting to see Cass for?" asked Mrs. Six-Toed curiously, as she wiped the baby's dirty face with a still dirtier apron.
If it's about that Sunday school concert, she can't go in that. She hasn't a decent rag. How can her and I ask you?
It's not the concert, said Nan drearily. She might well tell Mrs. Thomas the whole story. You would have to know it anyhow.
I came to tell her. To tell her that she is me and I'm her.
Perhaps Mrs. Sixtoad might be forgiven for not thinking this very lucid.
You must be cracked, she said. Whatever on earth do you mean?
Nan lifted her head. The worst was now over.
I mean that Cassie and I were born the same night, and the nurse changed us because she had a spite at Mother, and Cassie ought to be living in Ingleside and having advantages.
This last phrase was one she had heard her Sunday school teacher use, but Nan thought it made a dignified ending to a very lame speech. Mrs. Sixtoad stared at her.
Am I crazy, or are you? What you've been saying doesn't make any sense. Who ever told you such a rigmarole?
Dovey Johnson.
Mrs. Sixtoad threw back her tousled head and laughed. She might be dirty and draggled, but she had an attractive laugh.
I might have knowed it. I've been washing for her aunt all summer, and that kid is a pill. My, doesn't she think it's smart to fool people? Well, little miss, what's your name? You'd better not be believing all Dovey's yarns, or she'll lead you a merry dance.
Do you mean it isn't true? Gasped Nan.
Not very likely. Good glory, you must be pretty green to fall for anything like that. Cass must be a good year older than you. Who on earth are you, anyhow?
I'm Nan Blythe.
Oh, beautiful thought. She was Nan Blythe. Nan Blythe, one of the Ingleside twins. Why, I remember the night you were born. I happened to call at Ingleside on an errand. I wasn't married to Sixtoad then, more's the pity I ever was, and Cass's mother was living and healthy, with Cass beginning to walk.
You look like your dad's mother.
She was there that night, too, proud as punch over her twin granddaughters. And to think you'd no more sense than to believe a crazy yarn like that.
I'm in the habit of believing people, said Nan, rising with a slight stateliness of manner, but too deliriously happy to want to snub Mrs. Sixtoad very sharply.
Well, it's a habit you'd better get out of in this kind of a world, said Mrs. Sixtoad cynically, and quit running round with kids who like to fool people. Sit down, child. You can't go home till the shower's over. It's pouring rain and dark as a stack of black cats. Why, she's gone. The child's gone.
Nan was already blotted out in the downpour. Nothing but the wild exultation born of Mrs. Sixtoad's assurances could have carried her home through that storm. The wind buffeted her. The rain streamed upon her. The appalling thunderclaps made her think the world had burst open. Only the incessant icy blue glare of the lightning showed her the road. Again and again she slipped and fell, but at last she reeled dripping into the hall at Ingleside. Mother ran and caught her in her arms.
Darling, what a fright you have given us! Oh, where have you been?
I only hope Jem and Walter won't catch their deaths out in that rain searching for you, said Susan, the sharpness of strain in her voice. Nan had almost had the breath battered out of her. She could only gasp as she felt Mother's arms enfolding her.
Oh, Mother, I'm me, really me. I'm not Cassie Thomas, and I'll never be anybody but me again.
The poor pet is delirious, said Susan. She must have ate something that disagreed with her. Anne bathed Nan and put her to bed before she would let her talk. Then she heard the whole story.
Oh, Mummy, am I really your child?
Of course, darling. How could you think anything else?
I didn't ever think Dovey would tell me a story. Not Dovey.
Mummy, can you believe anybody?
Jen Penny told die-awful stories.
They are only two girls out of all the little girls you know, dear. None of your other playmates has ever told you what wasn't true. There are people in the world like that, grown-ups as well as children. When you are a little older, you will be better able to tell the gold from the tinsel.
Mummy, I wish Walter and Jem and Di needn't know what a silly I was.
They needn't. Di went to Lowbridge with Daddy, and the boys need only know you went too far down the harbor road and were caught in a storm. You were foolish to believe Dovey, but you were a very fine, brave little girl to go and offer what you thought her rightful place to poor little Cassie Thomas. Mother is proud of you. The storm was over. The moon was looking down on a cool, happy world.
Oh, I'm so glad I'm me, was Nan's last thought as she fell on sleep.
Gilbert and Anne came in later to look on the little sleeping faces that were so sweetly close to each other. Diana slept with the corners of her firm little mouth tucked in, but Nan had gone to sleep smiling. Gilbert had heard the story and was so angry that it was well for Dobby Johnson that she was a good 30 miles away from him. But Anne was feeling conscience-stricken. I should have found out what was troubling her. But I've been too much taken up with other things this week, things that really mattered nothing compared to a child's unhappiness. Think of what the poor darling has suffered. She stooped repentantly, gloatingly over them. They were still hers, wholly hers to mother and love and protect. They still came to her with every love and grief of their little hearts. For a few years longer they would be hers. And then? Anne shivered. Motherhood was very sweet, but very terrible. I wonder what life holds for them, she whispered.
At least, let's hope and trust they'll each get as good a husband as their mother got, said Gilbert teasingly.
Chapter 32.
So the Ladies' Aid is going to have their quilting at Ingleside, said the doctor. Bring out all your lordly dishes, Susan, and provide several brooms to sweep up the fragments of reputations afterwards.
Susan smiled wanly, as a woman tolerant of a man's lack of all understanding of vital things. But she did not feel like smiling, at least until everything concerning the aid supper had been settled. Hot chicken pie, she went about murmuring, mashed potatoes and creamed peas for the main course. And it will be such a good chance to use your new lace tablecloth, Mrs. Doctor dear. Such a thing has never been seen in the Glen, and I am confident it will make a sensation. I am looking forward to Annabel Clough's face when she sees it. And will you be using your blue and silver basket for the flowers? Yes, full of pats and yellow-green ferns from the maple grove. And I want you to throw three magnificent pink geraniums of yours somewhere around, in the living room if we quilt there, on the balustrade of the veranda if it's warm enough to work out there. I'm glad we have so many flowers left. The garden has never been so beautiful as it has been this summer, Susan. But then I say that every autumn, don't I? There were many things to be settled. Who should sit by whom? It would never do, for instance, to have Mrs. Simon Millicent sit by me. They knew because some of your dating to school days dashed into invite, for it was the hottest privilege to ask a few guests apart from members of the aid. I'm going to ask Mrs. Austin and Mrs. Amsterdam. Susan looked doubtful. They are newcomers, Mrs. Doctor dear. Much as she might have said, they are crocodiles. The doctor and I were newcomers once, Susan. Dr. Cole was here years before that. Nobody knows anything about these Bests and Campbells. But it is your house, Mrs. Doctor dear, and who am I to object to anyone you wish to have? I remember one quilting and Miss Carter Flagg's many years ago, when Miss Flagg and I had a strange woman. She came in with see Mrs. Doctor dear, said she didn't think a lady's aid would fall. At least there will be near that Campbell. She's fit dressed, so I could never be marrying a dress to church. Goodner, she dared not smile, thought that dress was lovely with Mrs. Campbell's silver hair, Susan. And by the way, Spirella says she had them at the harvest home supper, and it was delicious. Oh, well, Mrs. Doctor dear, it is not everyone can make five gooseberry. No Miss Campbell was expressed by her blue dresses. Mrs. Campbell might henceforth appear in the costume of a Fiji Islander, if she chose, and Susan would find excuses for it. The young months had grown old, but autumn was still remembering summer, and quilting day was more like June than October. Every member of the Ladies' Aid could possibly come, came, looking forward pleasurably to a dish of gossip and an Ingleside supper, besides, possibly, seeing some sweet new thing in fashions, since the doctor's wife had recently been to town. Susan, unbowed by the culinary airs that were heaped upon her, stood about, showing her lace to the guest room, serene in the knowledge that not one of them possessed an apron trimmed with crochet lace, 5 inches deep, made from number 100 thread. Susan had captured first prize at the town exhibition the week before with that lace. She and Rebecca Dew had trysted there and made a day of it, and Susan had come home that night the proudest woman in Prince Edward Island. Susan's face was perfectly controlled, but hers were her own, sometimes spiced with a trifle of mild malice. Julia Reese is here, something to she find out at the table, and that you may tie to. Myra Murray, in red velvet, a little too sumptuous for a quilting, in my opinion, and nothing looks well in it. See, and her tie the string as usual, Sarah Taylor. It may be her last quilting. She has got a terrible heart, the doctor says, but the spirit of her. Mrs. Donald Reed. Thank the good Lord she didn't marry with her, but we are glad she isn't a member of the aid. Well, I shall count the spoons after her and that tie, too. That family were all I fingered. Cass Crawford. She doesn't often trouble an aid meeting, but a quilting is a good place to show off her pretty hands and her diamond ring. Emma Pollock with her petticoat showing below her dress course. A pretty woman, but flimsy mind like all that tribe. Tilly McAllister. Don't you go set the jelly on this book like you did at Mrs. Palmer's quilting. My Crothers, you will have a decent meal for one. It is too bad your husband could not have come, too. He has to have on nuts or something like that. Mrs. Elder Baxter, the air had way for Minna at last. Harold always had a wishbone in place of a backbone, and faint heart, never one fair lady, as the good book says. Well, we have enough for two quilts, and some over 2 needles. The quilts were set up on the broad veranda. Everyone was busy with fingers and tongues. Anne and Susan were preparations for supper kitchen, and Walter, who had been kept home from school that day because of a slight sore throat, was screened from view of the quilters by curtain vines. He always liked to listen to older people talking. They said such surprising serious things, things you could think over afterwards and weave into the very stuff of drama, things that reflected the colors and shadows, the comedies and tragedies, the jests and sorrow even. Of the women present, Walter liked Mrs. Myra Marie best, with her easy, infectious laugh, and the jolly little wrinkles round her eyes. She could tell the simplest story, make it seem dramatic and vital. She gladdened life wherever she went, and she did look so pretty in her cherry-red velvet, with the smooth ripples in black hair, and the little red drops in ears. Mrs. Tom Chubb, who was thin as a needle, he liked least, perhaps because he once heard calling him sickly child. He and Mrs. Anne Miller waved just like sleepy hen, and Mrs. Grant Clow was like nothing so much as hair on legs. Young Dade Ransom, with her taffy-colored hair, was very handsome. Too handsome for a farm, Susan said, when Dave married her. The young bride, Mrs. Morton McDougal, looked like a sleepy white poppy. Edith Bailey, the Glen dressmaker, with her misty silver curls and humorous black eyes, didn't look as she should be an old maid. He liked Miss Meek, the oldest woman there, who had gentle, tall eyes and listened far more than she talked. And he didn't like Celia Reese, with her sly, amused look as she were laughing at everybody. Quilters had not really started talking yet. They were discussing the weather and deciding whether quilt in fans or diamonds, so Walter was thinking of the beauty of the ripened day, big lawns, magnificent trees, and the world looked as if some great kind being had put golden arms about it. The tinted leaves were drinking slow down, but the nightly hollyhock still gay against the brick wall, and the pillars wove sorcery of aspen on the path to the barn. Walter was absorbed in loveliness around him that the quilting conversation was in full swing before he was recalled to consciousness of it by Mrs. Simon Millicent's pronouncement. That lad were noted for sensational funerals. Will any of you who were there ever forget what happened at Peter's funeral? Walter pricked up his ears. This sounded interesting. But much to his disappointment, Mrs. Simon did not want to tell what happened. Everybody must either have been at the funeral or heard the story. But why are they all looking so uncomfortable about it? There is no doubt that Aunt Claire Wilson said about Peter was true. He is a great poor man, so let us leave him there. Mrs. Tom Chubb self-righteously, as anybody had proposed exhuming him. Marietta is always saying such clever things, said Mrs. Donald Reese. Do you know what she said the other day when we were starting to Margaret Holler's funeral? Ma said, will there be ice cream at the funeral? A few exchanged furtive amused smiles. Most of them ignored Mrs. Donald. It was really the only thing to do when she began dragging Mary Ann into London, in season and out of season. If you gave her an instrument, it's meaning. Do you know what Marietta said? Was a standing catchword in the glen. Talking of funerals, said Therese. It was a girl in Marinero and I was a girl. Stanton Lane had gone out west and Bert came back that he had died. His folks wired up the boss sent home, but Counterker advised them against spending the cat. The funeral had just got off to a good start when in walked Stanton Lane himself, hailed hard. Never found out who the corpse really was. What did they do with him? Queried Agadrew. Oh, they buried him. Wallace said it couldn't be put off, but you couldn't rightly call it a funeral with that one so happy or since her. Mr. Dalton changed the last hair from taking for Christians to sometimes light surprise, but most people thought better of well enough alone. Do you know what Marianna said to me the other day? She said, Ma, do the minister know everything? Miss Dawson always lost his head in a crisis, said Jane. The upper man was part of his charge then, and I remember one say he dismissed the congregation, and then remembered that the collection had been taken up. So what does he do but grab a collection plate and run round the yard with it? To be sure, added Jane, people gave that day, never gave before or after. They didn't like to refuse the minister. It was hardly dignified of him. What I had against Mr. Dawson, said Amelia, was the unmerciful lack of his prayer at a funeral. It actually came to such a pass that people said they envied the corpse. He surprised himself at Leanne's funeral. I saw her mother was on the point of fainting, so I gave him a good poke in the back with an umbrella, and told him he'd pray long enough. He buried my poor Jarvis, said Mrs. George Carter, tears dropping down. She always cried when she spoke of her husband, although he had been dead for 20 years. Sprub was a minister, too, said Christine Marsh. He was in the glen when I was a girl. We had a concert in the hall one night, and I was one of the speakers he was singing on the platform. He was as nervous as his brother, and he fidgeted him with his chair further and further back. And all at once he went there it all clean over the edge on a bank of floors and houseplants we had arranged round the base. All could mean it was his feet sitting up above the platform. Somehow it is spoiled preaching me after that. His feet were so big. The Lane funeral might have been a disappointment to my Pollock, but at least it was better not having any funeral at all. You remember the well mix-up? There was a chorus reminiscent. Let us hear the story, said Mrs. Amble. Remember, Mrs. Pollock, I am a stranger, and all the family sagas are quite unknown to me. Emma didn't know saga, but she'd tell a story. Abner Crowe lived over near Lowbridge on one of the big farms in the district, and he was a P.D. He was one of the biggest dogs in the Tory poll, and went with everybody of any importance on the island. He was married to Jude Flagg, whose mother was a Reese, and her grandmother was a Lowe, so they were connected with almost every family in Four Winds as well. One day a notice came out, Daily Enterprise. Mr. Abner Cromwell had died suddenly at Lowbridge, funeral be held at 2 o'clock the next afternoon. Somehow the Abner Cromwells missed seeing the notes, and of course there were no rural telephone those days. The next morning Abner left for Halifax to attend a liberal convention. At 2 o'clock people began arriving for the funeral, coming early to get good, and geared such a good on account of Abner being such a prominent man. And a crowd there was, believe me, for miles around the road were just a string of buggies, and people kept pouring in till about 3. Miss Abner's child crazy to men believe her husband wasn't dead. Some wouldn't believe her at first. He said to me in tears that they seemed to think she'd made away with the corpse. And when they were convinced, they acted as if they thought Abner ought to be dead, and they tramped all over the lawn flower bed was so proud of. The instant relations arrived too, expecting supper in bed the night, and hadn't much cooked. Julie was never very poor that had to be. At my home 2 days afterward, he found her in bed with nervous prostration, and she was months getting over it. She didn't eat a thing for 6 weeks. Well, hardly anything. I heard she said there really had been a funeral. She couldn't have been more upset. But I never believed she really did say it. You can't be sure, said Mrs. William McCreary. People do say such awful things. When they're upset, the truth pops out. Julie's sister Clarice actually went and sang a choir as usual the first Sunday after her husband was buried. Not even a husband's funeral could damp Clarice down for long. Drew, there was nothing said about her, always dancing and singing. I used to dance and sing on the shore, where nobody heard me, said Myra Murray. Oh, but you've grown wiser since then, said Agatha. No, foolisher, said Myra Murray slowly. Too foolish now to dance along her. At first, said Emma, not to be cheated out of a complete story, they thought the notice had been put in for a joke, because Abner had lost his election a few days before. But it turned, it was for an Asa Cromwell, living away in the backwoods the other side of Lowbridge, no relation at all. He had right. But it was a long time before people forgave Abner the disappointment, if they ever did. Well, it was a little inconvenient driving home right in planting time, too, and finding you had your journey for your pains, said Mrs. Tom Chubb defensively. And people like funerals as a rule, said Mrs. Donald Reese with spirit. We're all like to, I guess. I took Mary to her Uncle Gordon's funeral, and she enjoyed it so. Ma, couldn't we dig him up and have the fun of burying him over again, she said. They did laugh at this, everybody except Mrs. Elder Baxter, who primmed up her long, thin face and jabbed the quilt mercilessly. Nothing was sacred now. Everyone laughed at everything, but she, an elder's wife, was not to want to laugh or content with a funeral. Speaking of Abner, do you remember the obituary his brother John wrote for his wife? Asked Mrs. Allan Milgrave. It started out with, "What reasons best known to himself has been pleased my beautiful bride, and leave my cousin's ugly wife alive. Shall I ever forget the fuss it made?" How did it ever come to be printed at all? Asked Mrs. S. Why, he was managing editor of the Enterprise then. He took his wife, Bertha Morris, she was, and he hated Mrs. William Cromwell because she hadn't wanted him to marry Bertha. She thought Bertha too flighty. But she was pretty, said Elizabeth. The prettiest thing I ever saw in my life, agreed Mrs. Milgrave. Good looks ran in the Morrises. But fickle, fickle as a breeze. Nobody ever knew how she came to stay in one mind long enough to marry John. They say her mother kept her up to the notch. Bertha was in love with Fred Reese, but he was notorious for flirting. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, Mrs. Morris told her. I've heard that proverb all I remember. I wonder if it's true. Perhaps the birds in the bush could sing, and the one in the hand couldn't. Nobody knew just what say. Tom Chubb, anyhow. Always so whimsical, Myra. Do you know what Mary Alice said to me the other day? Said Mrs. Donald. She said, Ma, what will I do if nobody ever asks me to marry him? Us old maids could answer that, couldn't we? Asked Celia Reese, giving Edith Daly a nod with her elbow. Celia disliked Edith because Edith was still rather pretty and not entirely out of the running. Gertrude Cromwell was ugly, said Mrs. Grant Clough. She had a figure like a slat, but a great housekeeper. She washed Emma, and if Bertha washed hers once a year, it was as much as ever. and her window shades were all screwed. Gertrude said it just gave her the shivers to drive past John Cromwell's house. And yet John Cromwell worshipped Bertha, and William just put up with Gertrude. Oh, strange. They say William overslept on his wedding morning and dressed in such a tearing hurry, he got to the church with old shoes and odd socks on.
Well, that was better than Oliver Random, giggled Mrs. George Carr. He forgot to have a wedding suit made, and his old Sunday suit was simply impossible. It had been patched, so he borrowed his brother's best suit. It only fitted him here and there.
And at least William and Gertrude did get married, said Mrs. Simon. Her sister Caroline didn't. She and Ronnie Drew quarreled over what minister they'd have marry them, and never got married at all. Ronnie was so mad, he went and married Edna Stone before he'd time to cool off. Caroline went to the wedding. She held her head high, but her face was like death.
But she held her tongue, at least, said Sarah Taylor.
Philippa Abbey didn't. When Jim Mowbray jilted her, she went to his wedding and said the bitterest things out loud all through the ceremony. They were all, concluded Sarah Taylor, as if that accounted for any vagaries. Did she really go to the reception afterwards wearing all the jewelry Jim had given her while they were engaged? Asked Celia Reith. No, she didn't. I know how such stories get around, I'm sure. You'd think some people never did anything but repeat gossip. I dare say Jim Mowbray lived to wish he'd stuck to Philippa. His wife kept him down good and solid, though he always had a riotous time in her absence. The only time I ever saw Jim Mowbray was the night the Junes nearly stampeded Conscience at the anniversary in Lubridge, said Christine Crawford. And what June bugs left undone, Mowbray contributed. It was a hot night, and they had all been dipping. The June bugs just poured in and blundered about in hundreds. They picked up 87 dead bugs, a choir platform the next morning. Some of the women got hysterical when the bugs flew too near their faces. Just across the aisles from me, the new minister's wife was sitting, Mrs. Peter Loring. She had on a big lace hat with willow plumes. She was always considered far too dressy and extravagant for a minister's wife, interpolated Mrs. Elder Backer. Watch me flick that bug off this preacher's hat, I heard Jim Mowbray whisper. He was sitting right behind her. He leaned forward and aimed a blow at the bug, missed it, but sideswiped the hat and sent it skittering down the aisle clean to the communion railing. Jim almost had a conniption. When the minister saw his white hat come sailing through the air, he lost his place in his sermon, couldn't find it again, and gave up in despair. The choir sang the last hymn, dabbing at June bugs all the time. Jim went down and brought the hat back to Mrs. Loring. He expected to calm down, for she was said to be high-spirited. But she just stuck it on her pretty yellow head again and laughed at him. If you hadn't done that, she said, Peter would have gone on for another 20 minutes, and we'd all have been stark, staring mad. Of course, it was nice of her not to be angry, but people thought it wasn't just the thing for her to say of her husband.
But you must remember how she was born, said Martha Cruthers.
Why, how?
She was Bessie Talbot from Uppis. Her father's house caught fire one night, and in all the upheaval, Bessie was born.
Out in the garden, under the stars.
How romantic, said Myra Murray.
Romantic? I call it barely respectable.
But think of being born under the stars, said Myra dreamily. Why, she ought to have been a child of the stars, sparkling, beautiful, brave, true, with a twinkle in her eyes.
She was all that, said Martha, whether the stars were accountable for it or not. And a hard time she had in low-minute wine would be ruined in prisons. Why, one of the elders caught Anne around her baby cradle one day, and he told her she ought not to rejoice over her son until she found out if he acted or not.
Talking of babies, do you know what Mary Anna said the other day? Ma, she said, do queens have babies?
That must have been Alexander Wilson, said Mrs. Allen. A poor crab, if ever there was one. He wouldn't allow his family to speak a word at mealtimes, I've heard. As for laughing, there never was any doll in his house.
Think of us without laughter, said Myra. Why, it's sacrilegious.
Alexander used to take spells when he wouldn't speak to his wife for 3 days at a time, continued Mrs. Allen. It was such a relief to her, she added. Alexander Wilson was a good, honest businessman at least, said Mrs. Grant Clow stiffly. The said Alexander was her fourth cousin, and the Wilson's class. He left $40,000 when he got.
Such a pity he had to need it, said Celia Reese.
His brother Geoffrey did a vent, said Mrs. Clow. He was the ne'er-do-well of that family, I must admit.
Goodness knows he did enough laughing, spent everything he earned. Hail fellow well met with everyone, and died penniless. What did he get out of life with all his flinging about and laughing?
Not much, perhaps, said Myra, but think of all he put into it. He was always giving, cheer, sympathy, friendliness, even money. He was rich in friends, at least, and Alexander never had a friend in his life.
Jeff's friends didn't bury him, retorted Mrs. Allen. Alexander had to do that, and put up a real fine tombstone for him, too. It cost $100.
But when Jeff asked him for a loan of $100 to pay for an operation that might have saved his life, didn't Alexander refuse it? Asked Celia Drew.
Come, forgetting one terrible, protested Mrs. Oh, we'd live in a world of forget-me-nots and daisies. Everyone has faults.
Le Anderson is marrying Dorothy Clark today, said Mrs. Millison, thinking it was high time the conversation took a more cheerful line. And it isn't a Yeezy's war would blow out his brains if Jane Elliott wouldn't marry him.
Young men do say such odd things, said Mrs. Chubb, very close. It never leaked out till 3 weeks ago that they were engaged.
I was talking to his mother last week, and she never hinted at a wedding so soon. I'm sure that I care much for a woman who can be a sphinx.
I'm surprised at Dorothy Clark taking him, said Agatha Dew. I thought last spring that she and Frank Clowe were going to make a match of it.
I heard Dorothy say that Frank was the best match, but she really couldn't abide the thought of seeing that nose sticking out over the sheet every morning when she woke up.
Mrs. Elder Baxter gave a spinsterish shudder and refused to join in the laughter.
You shouldn't say such things before a young girl like Edith, said Celia, winking around the quilt.
Is Ada Clark engaged yet? Asked Emma Pollock.
No, not exactly, said Mrs. Millison. Just hopeful. But she'll land him yet. Those girls all have a knack of picking husbands. Her sister Pauline married the best farm over the harbor.
Pauline is pretty, but she is full of silly notions as ever, said Mrs. Milgrave. Sometimes I think she'll never learn any sense.
Oh, yes, she will, said Myra Murray. Some day she will have children of her own, and she will learn wisdom from them, as you and I did.
Where are Lem and Dorothy going to live? Asked Mrs. Meade.
Oh, Lem has bought a farm at the Upper Glen, the old Carey place, you know, where poor Mrs. Roger Carey murdered her husband.
Murdered her husband?
Oh, I'm not saying he didn't deserve it, but everybody thought she went a little too far.
Yes, weed killer in his teacup. Or was it his soup?
Everybody knew it, but nothing was ever done about it.
The spool, please, Celia.